B3. Number 20, B.
So this was one example. Let's go to the next point, 6. The title is Two Valued and One Valued Thinking. Two Valued and One Valued Thinking. So the accent is on thinking, and we investigate the nature of thinking. And you know that we have started out by seeing that human thinking is dualistic, that for every concept we can have an opposite concept. If you say above, I can say below. If you can say on the right, I can say on the left. And so we can see that human thinking per se, is dualistic. But we could also see that we have the possibility to investigate understanding, the understanding of God, and that understanding would bring us an evaluation of the two opposite concepts, and therefore show that one value is right. So from the point of understanding and mind, we only have the values of ideas. We see that mind and mind's ideas are actually the only values, and this brings us to the insight that ideas are actually beyond the question of good and evil. That when we talk about ideas, we actually are already on that one valued logic where we see ideas cannot be good or evil, right or wrong. That mind that creates only ideas, when realized by the human mind, that then they become divine concepts, no more human concepts. Can you see? I now take the descending way. In the first hour I have shown the ascending way from dualistic thinking to the one-valued understanding. Now, when I go out from the one understanding and see that mind only ideas and therefore tells the human conception which thinking is ideational and which is not ideational, then therefore my thinking is no more human because it is formed by the values of God, ideas. And so my thinking is no more human thinking, it's now divine thinking. It's still thinking, I'm thinking. But it's now molded and valued and evaluated by the divine ideas. And so we have divine concepts. That's why Mrs. Eddy then says that divine mind forms divine concepts. That she would say that there are God's thoughts. Though God doesn't think, see, God never thinks, and yet we have God's thoughts. Now what are God's thoughts? It is ideas translated to our way of thinking, but formed and coined and molded and evaluated by ideas, so it is divine thoughts. So we have to be careful when we read the textbook, because in most cases she will speak about thought in a negative way, and here and there she will speak about thoughts in a divine way. Angels are God's thoughts. And you always see that when it is a positive way, then it is not original human thinking, but then it is divine ideas having instructed our thinking. It's secondary thinking. It's reflecting thinking. So at that point we can say, see, at that point, that human thinking is divine. There only it is where we have the unity of divinity with humanity, where divinity embraces humanity, only there. So we cannot say thinking about God, you see, is divine. That's human. But thinking God-wise, thinking that has been formed and informed by divine mind, is divine thought, is divine thinking. Mind is that information that comes to us and puts in form our thinking. So whenever we go out from the divine mind and let that divine mind inform us, it informs the way of our thinking, and then that thinking is divine thinking, divine thoughts. So the great question that always comes up is thinking human or divine would have to be answered in two ways. It can be answered yes and no. Again, can you see at that point the law of identity is broken? It depends. It can be both. It depends only from where that thinking comes. If it comes from our thinking, when we start with the dualistic classical logic, then it is human. But that human thinking, when it is informed from above as a descending line, then that human thinking is divine. So there is no hard and fast answer to anything. We always have to see that we give the answer in a structural or even here in a dimensional way. But both ways we have seen have value. Namely, the ascending way of human thinking has the value of learning. Of learning. We have seen that learning is through trial and error, through being able to distinguish. And in the descending way, naturally, that human thinking has the value of the of understanding. At that point, we see it as understanding, because it can decide and distinguish between right and wrong. All right? Is that clear? We come to point 7, syllogism. Syllogism. In the textbook we read that Mrs. Eddy asks that Christian Science demands an accurately stated syllogism, and that her reasoning is always along a syllogism, and that she says that, I quote, if both the major and minor proposition of a syllogism are correct, the conclusion, if properly drawn, cannot be false. That's on page 31, I think. Now, what is a syllogism? In a syllogism, you first have to, so to say, to distinguish between a premise and conclusion. Perhaps I try to put it down. No? Now, in the premise, a syllogism demands a major proposition and a minor proposition. So, if one states a syllogism, one first states the major proposition in a short sentence, then usually beneath it the minor proposition, and then you make usually a line underneath, and underneath the line you write the conclusion. Now, what is the major and the minor proposition? And there it is important to know that you just don't make two statements, but that the major proposition is always a general statement, and that the minor proposition is a specific statement about the major proposition. Therefore, you can see in a syllogism, we do not just state two statements and then draw a conclusion. We make first a general statement, then a specific statement about the general statement, and from there we can draw a conclusion. The example that most textbooks bring, and I can put it here too, see, is that they take as a major proposition that they say all men are mortal. Major proposition. Then the minor proposition, we said, must be a specific case of the major proposition. So they take Socrates is a man. Then when you have these two statements on top of each other, then you draw a line under Socrates is a man, and then you draw the conclusion of it. How does one draw a conclusion here? We see that the major and minor proposition have a so-called middle term. A middle term is that term which is common to the major proposition and to the minor proposition. And that middle term does not appear in the conclusion. You leave it out. What is here the middle term? The middle term would be here, you see, that in common you have in the major, minor proposition, men. That's the middle term. So we can leave that out. And what we read then is actually that Socrates is mortal. Can you see? That Socrates is mortal. Have you written that down? Yes. So the conclusion is drawn by seeing what is the middle term of the major minor proposition, and leaving that middle term out and putting major minor proposition into one statement, you have the conclusion. So here is a very simple example. Naturally, not all examples are as simple as that, but the line of reasoning is exactly this way. So Mrs. Eddy always asks us that in order to draw proper conclusions, we must see that the major and minor proposition are stated accurately. And this is not as simple as we think it is. I will see as we go on, I will come back to this syllogism. These are the things you have to keep in mind. And as we come back to them, you will see that we can make great mistakes in writing down the major and minor proposition. So, in Christian Science, where she asks this, we must see that she says that her battle is actually against false premises, if the premises are already wrong. If we go out from the premises of matter and of mortality and of mortals, no matter if those statements are, from the human point of view, right, they are wrong propositions when reasoning in the realm of Christian Science. Therefore, we will always make a wrong syllogism when in the major or minor proposition appears a wrong basis. So we have to be very clear, and I will then in the course of this afternoon give you a few instances where whole books have been written on Christian Science, feeling that they have really seen something terrific, and when you reduce it, it is just on a very clearly, wrongly stated false syllogism. So error in the premise, she says, leads to error in conclusion. She goes as far as saying that such a logic which has a false premise would lead to the destruction of man. And I think that's what is meant, really, in the second record of creation, that the destruction of man began with the tree of knowledge of good and evil, with a conceptual false statement where they have taken good and evil as basis, as a premise, dualistic reality as a premise, and that led to the destruction of man. So she asks us in the reasoning never to reason from matter. She says human logic is awry. Human logic is awry when it attempts to draw correct conclusions regarding life from matter. And you see, it shows that the basis must be right. She asks us never to reason from duality, therefore never have a dualistic statement in the premise. A logical and scientific conclusion is reached only through the knowledge that there are not two bases of being, matter and mind, but one alone, mind. So here we have a very simple syllogism, but as you know, those things that are simple we usually don't consider and obey. Therefore, our syllogisms must always go out from the oneness of being, from the allness of being, and not to have any counterfacts stated in the premise in the syllogism. Okay. Let's take point 8. Two-valued logic is a preliminary step. Here I want to stress that in order to have a comprehensive logic in Christian Science, we must see that we accept that two-valued or two-conceptional logic as a preliminary step in order to arrive at a one-valued logic. I quote here from Mrs. Eddy, just to show you that what she means. She says, a knowledge of error and its operation must precede that understanding of truth which destroys error. We had that at the beginning of the week. She says, a knowledge of error must precede the understanding of truth. Can you see? A knowledge of error. As it's the two-valued logic that is necessary and must be cleared up first before we can have that understanding of truth which destroys error. So again we have a sense that the two-valued logic leads to the one-valued logic, and that the one-valued logic actually then destroys the two-valued logic and shows it as a two-conceptional logic. Until the eternal... Sorry, I should have read this sentence all through. I start all over again now with the accent on the second part. By the way, it's 252, line 8. 252, line 8. Again, I read, a knowledge of error and its operations must precede that understanding of truth which destroys error. You see, as a descending way. Until the entire mortal material error finally disappears. Again, we have the ascension. Until it disappears, and what is over? What is left over? The eternal verity, man created by and of spirit, is understood and recognized as the true likeness of his maker. Can you see that terrific, wonderful interchange of logics? A knowledge of error precedes truth. Then if you have truth, then the understanding of truth destroys the two-valued logic. Makes it what? A two-conceptional logic. And in a two-conceptional logic, only one of the two is real. And so it gives you the eternal verity of creation. And that is recognized as the only truth about being. In this way, there are many, many statements in the textbook that show you this way of reasoning. You can see how that one-valued logic really brings forth the two-conceptional logic. She says, the broadest fact, the most false it is against themselves. Here you have it again. The oneness of being is that which really brings to the surface more dualistic concepts than anything else. Isn't it terrific that the one-valued is that which really brings forth more and more two-valued concepts? The most falsities against themselves. For they bring error from undercover. Again, we see what we had at the beginning of the week, that Christian science makes both evil more and less. It says, now let truth, the one value, let truth uncover and destroy error in God's own way. Again, it is truth that makes us realize what is error, that brings to the surface what is error. You remember what we said? Why doesn't truth bring forth more truth? Well, it does naturally when you go upward in your scales. But when we have truth and look back, look down on the preceding level, then it brings forth more error. Because it uncovers error, because the higher truth is, the more we see what is the opposite of truth. And so brings forth the two conceptional logic. So again, it's always a question when one reads the textbook, does she write from a standpoint and does she look upward or does she look, so to say, downward, from a level? And every time, if you have such a standpoint, like here in Absolute Christian Science, where you have understanding and you look backward or downward to the level of Christian Science, you get more error to uncover. You realize more what is error than before, so it gives you a higher sense, a larger sense of what error really is. But if you can have many statements then in the textbook where she goes again out from that understanding of truth, that leads you into all truths, there you have an upward trend. So you see how important those levels are for the interpretation of the textbook. Without them, we lose our orientation. She says, by the law of opposites, after the truth of man has been demonstrated, what appears? The postulate of error must appear. It is even a must. Here again, it is looking back to the level of Christian Science. Therefore, there the error must appear. Do you know what that means and what that implies in practice, you see? In practice, it implies that if we know the truth, that we should not be taken by surprise that more error comes to the surface. Though we should not be either surprised if more truth is revealed. Both. The one is the descending way, the other is the ascending way. And therefore this logic is a different logic. You see, in the classical logic, only one thing could appear, because it has identity. So it breaks the classical logic again. And little by little you see that not much is left of the classical logic. So why should a thinker in the world who reads the textbook, should he understand it, unless he accepts a new logic? This is his practice. This is our practice, that we are willing to accept first a new logic in order to see more of the text. All right. It's afternoon, we go.